From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last Thursday, October 1st, in two separate locations. The first, the White House, where President Obama was decrying another mass shooting. He was talking about the Oregon shootings, and the president said that this country has refused to adopt the kind of laws that would possibly prevent that kind of tragedy. He invoked Australia as one example of a nation that has responded to a mass shooting with much more restrictive gun laws. At almost the same time, in North Florida, a man went looking for his estranged wife, and when he found her, he began shooting. He killed two people while critically wounding another before killing himself. On this program in recent days, we've talked about gun control proposals. We've looked at why the Australian model probably won't travel to our country. But through it all, it seems that we rarely hear of people changing their minds about big issues like guns. That's why my guest today brings such valuable perspective. Michael Shermer, the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, is a monthly columnist for Scientific American and the author of the book The Moral Arc: How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. He's also written for years about the way human beings form beliefs and why those beliefs are so difficult to change, even in the face of new evidence. And Michael Shermer has changed his own views on a number of the largest issues facing our country today, including climate change and gun violence. We'll get to that. Let me welcome Michael Shermer. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Well, and before we dive into the conversation with Michael, I'll tell our listeners you can join the program today. We always welcome participation, and it is the start of an important time, a pledge drive for us. Randy Gorbin is the news director from WXXI, and a brief visit from Randy to say hello. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Evan. And of course, this is a big year for us and a big afternoon. We're trying to do a lot of things here to improve the product, as we always are here at WXXI, something that in public broadcasting is kind of unique. I've been in this business a long time, but coming over to the public side of things, it's nice to see all of the money that we raise and we ask for help put right back into the product. Among the ways we do that is really just expanding an incredible job you're already doing with this show. Recently, over the last week, Evan got a new producer, Megan Mack. She's with us at the studio, actually, instead of screening and talking to listeners right now. And Megan, you have an interesting history. You worked both in TV as a producer and also at the U of R, correct?
Yes, I have a public relations background and a television background.
What made you want to get into public broadcasting?
I think public broadcasting is so important because we can devote the time and energy and resources to really expanding on stories and investigating them and bringinging this information to the public. There's so much more capacity and time to do that.
Really, this week kind of started with both feet. I mean, you were, I think we had training for maybe about 2 hours with you.
Right.
Yeah,
into
I'm an old timer now. Been here 5 days.
I hear Evan across the hall already yelling, Megan, get me some. But really, Evan, this
I'm
is the
summoned.
You're summoned, but it's important because, again, Evan does this, I'm saying, you know, Fronty, to compliment you, but you do such an incredible job on research and working on some of these topics, but you really need somebody like Megan to help you flesh out some of the things we're doing and even expand on what we're doing. So we're looking forward to having her.
Well, it's great to have Megan, and Megan and I have a very similar viewpoint in that you're about to hear a conversation at length with an author, a scientist, a writer, and these are the kind of subjects that, unfortunately, a lot of news outlets try to cover in about 30 to 60 seconds, let alone 30 to 60 minutes. And that's what we value. So, Megan, it's great to have you here, and I can't wait to do more with you here. And I hope our audience supports us because it's so valuable to us.
And again, you can call in now at 454-6300. That's 454-6300. Or very easy to do this online, a secure online site, WXXI.org. Operators, as they say, are sitting by right now and waiting to take your calls and chat with you. And please, if you like this program, show your support.
All right. Thank you, Randy. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
And let's get to our conversation with Michael Shermer. He's on the line with us now. And as I open the hour, I want to let our listeners know we've been having an interesting conversation on Twitter this morning with those. I asked a basic question. When's the last time you changed your mind on a big issue? And we're getting some interesting responses. Michael Shermer, that's an easy answer for you. You change your mind with some frequency. And I always say, as a proud skeptic myself, I love when new evidence changes my mind. It's invigorating to me. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If particularly if I don't have a big commitment to a belief system like gun control or climate change, you know, the two big ones I've changed my mind on recently, then it's easy to do. I understand why people have a hard time doing it if they're, you know, running for political office on a certain set of beliefs or something like that. But as a scientist, you know, that's my job, is to follow the evidence, and we're not supposed to decide what we want to be true ahead of time and then find the evidence that fits it, confirmation bias. We're supposed to follow the evidence. And So in my case, yeah, I do find it invigorating because it means that I'm not stuck with the beliefs I have. I could change my mind about other things.
Well, and you've written about why people are so entrenched and the way, you know, it's just sort of this epistemological study. And I'd like to kind of work through some of that. But let me also start by backing up and working through the way you have evolved on certain positions. I want to read what you wrote about climate change, for example. And here's what you wrote in the last couple of years about that. Quote, "My libertarianism also once clouded my analysis on climate change. I was a longtime skeptic, mainly because it seemed to me that liberals were exaggerating the case for global warming as a kind of secular millenarianism, an environmental apocalypse requiring drastic government action to save us from doomsday through countless regulations that would handcuff the economy and restrain capitalism, which I hold to be the greatest enemy of poverty. Then I went to the primary scientific literature on climate and discovered that there is convergent evidence from multiple lines of inquiry that global warming is real and human-caused." End quote. Like you, Michael, I accept the scientific community's evidence on climate change, but still many of your libertarian colleagues probably find what you just wrote anathema to their belief system. And I'm curious to know the kind of feedback you have gotten since you've written about climate change this way.
A little bit of pushback from some libertarians, you know, like he's a traitor to the cause. But that's sort of my point. There shouldn't be a cause that one could be a traitor to. In principle, we should be able to know whether the Earth is getting warmer or not, and if it is getting warmer, what the cause is, human or natural causes. And we do know that. We do know it's getting warmer. We do know the primary cause is human action. So that's just the way it is. Whether you want it to be true or not is irrelevant. The universe is going to be the way it is. Now, other issues are not quite so clearly data-driven, like, you know, which tax system should we have? How much should hedge fund managers be taxed? You know, that's not going to be an issue like climate change. That's going to vary depending on your beliefs, and there's probably not a scientific answer to that question. But where we can get at it, like do gun control laws decrease the number of mass public shootings and the number of homicides? Well, that depends. Let's look at these case by case, and let's look at the data. There we can get a better handle on it, even though it's a super politically charged issue. There's still some answers we can get to with data, and those I try to follow wherever the science leads.
Changing your mind again on the question of gun violence, and again, Michael is not an absolutist, but I was really moved by what you wrote about your own experience about being a lifelong gun owner, the Magnum 357 you had in your house, and the reason you decided to get guns out of your house. Can you share that story?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I was raised with shotguns in the house, and my stepfather used to take me and my brothers hunting for years. Many, you know, probably 15 years. I did this pretty regularly: dove, duck, and quail. You know, it was just kind of a sport for me. As you know, like playing baseball, playing basketball, and going hunting. It was pretty much all the same kind of thing. And then, you know, I grew out of that and went off to do other sports like bike racing when I got older. But I got a handgun for home protection, for, self-defense and all that, living in a community that, you know, had some rates of crime that were higher than I was comfortable with. So I thought, well, I should just do this. And so the first alarming thing for me was shooting a revolver is nothing like shooting a rifle or a shotgun. It is way harder to hit a target, and there's a huge kick with these revolvers, and it would be so easy to shoot yourself or somebody else by accident. So I started, you know, training and practicing with it, but then, like these things are wont to go, you know, it sits there locked up in the house for months at a time, and then years went by without my taking it to the range. And then when my wife and I started having marital problems, and I could see how this could escalate, you know, in her and in me. You know, I could feel the, you know, the heat boiling up inside when I would get mad about something. You know, we'd yell and scream at each other, and maybe a few dishes were broken. But I could see how it could escalate. So I thought, you know what, let's just take this off the table. I'm getting rid of the gun. Because I started reading about this. And, you know, about 90% of homicides are moralistic in nature. That is, they aren't instrumental where the guy robs a bank and shoots the teller or robs the liquor store and shoots the employee. Most of them are, you know, the honor killing or a gang shooting or a love triangle, a jealous husband or boyfriend. You know, that's about 90% of homicides are moralistic in nature. The essentially, the perpetrator is the judge, jury, and executioner of a capital punishment of somebody that he considers to be deserving of the death penalty. I mean, that, you know, it all happens within seconds in your brain, but that's essentially what it boils down to. And I didn't want any part of that, so I got rid of it. We sold it, and you know, good riddance. I don't have a gun now anymore. But if I did, I mean, I'm not against it. I could see myself getting a handgun again, but I wouldn't do it unless I practice, because it's not easy to do. It's really a very serious thing to have. I equate it to like getting an airline pilot, you know, a pilot's license to fly a plane. You know, this is not something you just screw around with, like, you know, let's go for a bike ride. It's not like that. You know, it's pretty serious. Could be potentially dangerous. You know, we've seen the statistics on the number of not just homicides, but suicides and accidental gun deaths, you know, are more than the homicides. You know, so tens of thousands of people.
Yep. Yeah. And you cite evidence in your piece for the LA Times this week, 22 times more likely with a gun in our household for that gun to be used as either in either a suicide, an accidental death, kids, et cetera, or as a homicide generally against women. 22 times more likely to be used that way than to be used in the way that a lot of people sort of see in the movies and envision themselves doing when someone invades their home.
Yeah, you know, we all have the fantasy from watching Dirty Harry and all the, you know, the films about, you know, the good guy killing the bad guy. You know, the NRA idea of, you know, the solution to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. The problem is that, you know, good guys with guns, like cops and military, who practice and train, that's true. That's fine. One of the causes of the decline of violence and crime over the last 25 years has been just that, you know, just better policing, you know, better training and so on. But the average Joe doesn't have that training, like me. Like, you know, okay, so I got the gun, I went to the range, practiced. Okay, I got reasonably good at it. But then, you know, then you don't go for a couple of years and the training's gone. And so you have to have that, absolutely, or else you're going to shoot yourself accidentally. You can go to YouTube and watch these videos of people shooting themselves accidentally. Even cops and military people at a shooting range, this happens. I mean, it happens even with trained people. So, again, it's not a toy. You know, 33,636 injured by gunfire last year, 2014. 21,175 killed themselves with a gun. So you got your gun in the house and you forget to lock it up, and a depressed relative shoots themselves, or your kids get it, or your kids' friends find it, you know, or whatever. You and your spouse have a fight and it escalates. You know, there's just so many things that could go wrong. Again, 22 times more likely to be shot by your own gun or shoot somebody. A relative or a relative shoots themselves or you with your own gun, then that you, the good guy, shoots the bad guy entering your house to take your stuff.
Right.
You know, that's just rare.
My guest is Michael Shermer, the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, and the author of the new book, The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. Some of you have been weighing in online about where the last big case of you changing your own mind on an issue was, and that's been interesting. Michael is really kind of the textbook example of the open mind, the open to evidence, and the willingness to change your mind from climate change to the question of gun control. Doesn't mean that Michael is in favor of a national gun ban, and he just wrote about that, the piece often circulated this past weekend, which we're going to be getting to. But let me also back up, Michael, and ask you to talk a little bit more about the way we form beliefs. Why is it that most people are not like you, unfortunately? I think most people feel like they've got a belief and they're going to fight for that no matter what evidence you bring to them. What is it about the way we construct beliefs that's so often the case?
Well, basically, our brains were designed to be more like lawyers than scientists. That is, to win the case, to marshal evidence in support of our client. In this case, our client is our belief system, whether it's, you know, religious beliefs and political beliefs and economic ideologies are particularly potent examples of this. You start off, you know, I'm a conservative or I'm a liberal. And so I'm going to read, I'm a liberal, I'm going to read the New York Times, I'm going to listen to NPR, or I'm a conservative, I'm going to watch Bill O'Reilly and listen to Rush. And the reason you do that is because you're not really interested in knowing, you know, what's the truth out there. What you're interested in knowing is what's the evidence, the talking points I can use in my debates with my buddies at work, you know, who are a bunch of bleeding heart, you know, bedwetting liberals, and I'm a hard-ass conservative. You know, I want the arguments in my favor, you know. So that's what most of us do most of the time with those kinds of beliefs, religious, political, economic, ideological. And it's really hard to break out of that. I have a hard time doing that. You know, I have certain beliefs myself. And, you know, I find myself flipping into that. Let's just read the, you know, the op-ed pieces that support what I already believe and so on. And so you really have to force yourself to go to the other side. Let's see what the other side has to say. Not a cardboard cutout of the other side, but the actual other side. You know, like Paul Krugman at the New York Times, for example. He's way more liberal than I'm comfortable with economically, but I read him. I forced myself to read him because I thought, okay, this guy, you know, he's the best on the other side. So I really should hear what he has to say. Not what Rush says, Rush Limbaugh says that liberals believe, but what they actually write, you know, that kind of thing. And it's hard to do that. But the reason for that is because we're a social primate species. We really want to get along with our fellow in-group members. We want to show that we're not, you know, wishy-washy, flip-flopping, you know, amoral team players, that you can count on me. I'm consistent. I'm unwavering. I'm a good team player and a good group member. And so we have a tendency to want to reinforce to our fellow, you know, group members that, you know, you can count on me. I'm always there for you, and I'm not a flip-flopper. That's why that whole flip-flopping thing is such a thing in politics. Like it's wrong if there's new evidence to change your mind. Well, that, you know, just the opposite is true in science.
Before we get to your phone calls, I'll tell you again, it's Michael Shermer for the hour here, the publisher of Skeptic Magazine and an author. His new book is called The Moral Arc. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, your new book is The Moral Arc, and author Steven Pinker has called it a kind of sequel to his landmark work, The Better Angels of Our Nature. I want to briefly read from what Pinker says about your new book, Michael. He says, quote, "If you wanted a sequel to The Better Angels of Our Nature, one which explores all of our spheres of moral progress, not just the decline of violence, Michael Shermer's The Moral Arc is it. Shermer has engaged the full mantle of moral progress and considered how far we have come and how much farther that arc can be bent toward truth, justice, and freedom." But Michael, while you and Pinker have written about the worldwide decline in violence, you also write about your concern about gun violence. Some of your libertarian colleagues, for example, at Reason, they say you're overplaying gun violence while ignoring the decline in all violence, and that, you know, part of the allegation, I don't think against you, but against those who want more gun control, is that, well, you ignore the decline in worldwide violence because you want more government intervention here. What do you say about the dovetailing with your concern about gun violence with the decline in worldwide violence?
Well, that is kind of the libertarian talking line, that people use incidents like this to try to increase laws. And that's true. That does happen. But the question is, instead of moralizing about it and saying, well, you know, whether this is good or bad from an ideological perspective, let's just ask the question, first of all, do we have a problem? And I think most people would agree that 30,000 to 33,000 people a year dying by guns is a problem. We are about to surpass the number of people die on the roads and highways of America from automobile accidents. And everybody knows that's a problem that we've been working at for decades. You know, adding seatbelts and airbags and, you know, adjusting speeds and things like self-driving cars eventually. You know, all that is directed toward this attempt to decrease the carnage. And that would be the point of gun control laws. Now, you know, before we get into this, we should say off the bat that, you know, the Supreme Court has voted twice in 2008 and 2010 on two different issues about handguns, that they are protected under the Second Amendment. No one's going to take anybody's handguns away. It would be unconstitutional. It would be illegal. It's not going to happen. And the Supreme Court is not going to hear another case probably for another decade or two, if one even came up. So, if you're you know, a gun advocate, don't think that anybody's going to do that. No one's going to do that. President Obama's not creating concentration camps to put people who have guns. You know, these are all silly urban legends and myths that are not true. So that said, is there something we could do? And I think, again, the analogy of, like, getting a pilot's license. Shouldn't you be trained? You know, now, most gun advocates, including the NRA, members of the NRA anyway, you know, say, yes, absolutely, a gun is a serious thing. You should have training and practice. You should be licensed, background checks, mental health checks, you know, constrictions on the size of magazines, you know, 10 bullets rather than 30 or 40 or 50. And all of those are just a way of reducing the carnage. There's no way we're going to end, you know, all gun violence. There's no way we're going to stop Sandy Hook type events, that is, mass public shootings, four or more killed in a single incident, as the FBI defines it. There were 30 last year. There's 31 as of October 1st with the Oregon shooting. The number of people killed in mass public shootings are trivial compared to the number died in homicides, like 500 versus 30,000. It's nothing, but they're huge public media events, of course, because they're, you know, they're senseless and the carnage is just, you know, awful. So we want to do something about it. You know, that's much more difficult to do something about because of its unpredictability. It's a black swan kind of event, just super unusual. And so I think the place we should go for is more of background checks, magazine size restrictions, things like that, that can just reduce the carnage, if not stop the event itself. And so there, I think some of the modest proposals that most gun advocates already believe, I think, is the way to go.
Let me read from what you wrote on skeptic.com that helps frame some of this up for us. You write, even though it is not clear that the two suggested laws, banning assault rifles and banning large capacity magazines over 10 bullets, would have a significant effect on mass murders, there could be a net gain, and it seems to me to be no great threat to liberty if we lump them with the already existing bans on private citizens owning and operating bazookas, tanks, drone aircraft, fighter jets, and nuclear weapons. Bans on semi-automatic assault rifles and high-volume ammo clips will not stop Sandy Hook events, but there is some evidence that they could curtail the level of carnage, and that strikes me as a rational response that even freedom-loving libertarians can live with. 2 points there, Michael. First of all, on the magazines, I want to hit the magazines a little bit harder here, because what you are saying is you're not going to stop someone who wants to commit a mass murder, but that moment of having to reload could be the moment of stopping that person. We saw it with, I think, Jared Loughner, and just that brief window of time you get. So the high-capacity magazines, to you, is a logical one based on some of the evidence?
Yes, absolutely. At the Gabby Giffords shooting, the guy was stopped when he was reloading. So, you know, the carnage was probably reduced there. And that seems reasonable. And just think about this now. If you were on a flight at 30,000 feet and somebody jumped up in the aisle and said, you know, we're commandeering this plane, everybody just stay in your seats and everything is going to be fine. You know what would happen. You know, guys would jump up and swarm this guy because since 9/11, we know what the outcome of these things is likely to be. So why can't we do something like that? Let's just sort of retrain our thinking along the lines of, you know, we have to swarm a shooter like this. Now, this is not easy to do. But if he's having to reload, if there's a pause, that's a moment when you know, bystanders can become heroes, so to speak, you know, but try to stop the carnage, even though we can't stop the guy from coming into the school in the first place or something like that. I mean, having armed security guards at every school, first of all, would be super expensive, but also assumes that the person is, you know, ready to go. I mean, basically almost needs to have his hand on his gun, because, you know, just a kid could just walk up with, you know, with a backpack and just blow his brains out without him even, you know, being able to respond. And then you're in the school and the carnage begins. So I'm not sure armed guards at every single school is a solution. But, again, the magazine restriction size at least is a help.
Okay, and then on the question of assault rifles, what you said there had to get some feedback from your fellow libertarians when you say, it seems to me to be no great threat to liberty if we lump them in with the already existing bans on the other things you mentioned, tanks, drone yeah. aircraft, et cetera, because there are those on the libertarian side who have said, that is overreach. I enjoy it. It is useful. I know how to use this, and you cannot come and take this from me. So how do you respond to them?
Again, if we're going to do that, then why not, you know, license with, and you have to have, you know, every year you have to have a check that you're still able to shoot this thing safely. You gotta go down and get your license renewed at a gun range or something like that. I would just like to see more restrictions on how the licenses are given and the kind of training that somebody has. I mean, these weapons are designed specifically for one thing and one thing only, is to kill people. That's what they're made for. I mean, I realize shotguns, since I was raised for them, for example, are good for killing birds. And my father, and we used to eat what we shot. Okay, so that, you know, I get the hunting thing. It's a sport, you know. Especially if you eat your game, okay, that's even better. That's all fine and good. But I do know I've never shot an automatic rifle or an AK-47 or anything like that. But my friends tell me it's great fun to do. Okay. It's great fun. Well, then, you know, how about a license? How about, you know, you do it at a gun range, you know, something like that, and where they're maybe not stored at your house, where somebody can get them and do damage, something like that. Because, you know, the Oregon shooter, for example, he had no trouble getting his gun. He wouldn't have been stopped by any of the things I'm proposing. But, you know, again, just having that much hardware in your house just makes it that much easier for somebody to do something like that. So even if we're talking strictly from a freedom perspective, yes, you're free to have guns as many as you want. Should you? Really? I mean, what's the wisest thing for you to do as the head of your family? With all things considered, you know, not just I'm free to have fun with my guns. Yes, that's part of being an American under the Second Amendment. But what about your responsibility as a gun owner? Don't you have a responsibility to protect people from your guns? You should have your gun in a lockbox. Is it in the lockbox? You know, can you get to it quickly enough to stop an intruder, but your kids can't get to it, or the neighbors can't get to it, or your infuriated spouse or your depressed relative can't get to it? You know, have you been responsible? I think that seems most gun owners would agree. Yeah, of course, we should have responsibility for our guns.
Let's get a short break and come back with your phone calls for Michael Shermer. My guest on the line for the hour is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's a monthly columnist for Scientific American. His new book is The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. We've been talking about his work writing for Skeptic.com, for the LA Times, and some other sources about the evidence behind guns in this country, among other things. And you tell me your audience feedback for Michael Shermer is next. Coming up in our second hour, more schools on the elementary level are canceling or reducing the amount of time kids have in recess. We are looking at the evidence for play-based education. What does the research show when it comes to a connection between play and physical learning and learning and cognition later in life? That's our conversation next hour here on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Supporting your favorite programs on WXXI TV and radio is just a click away when you go public at WXXI.org. It's a convenient and secure way of supporting an important community resource. WXXI.org. Go public and pledge your support today.
Welcome back to Connections. My news director, Randy Gorbin, popping back in. Hello, Randy.
How are you? And I think Brenda Tremblay said it so well there, our Go Public campaign, that phrase that, of course, we came up with here some years ago. But it really says it all. We are public radio, and that means we depend on your support. This is a very important fund drive for us. Just listening to the fascinating conversation, Evan, with your guest, Michael Shermer, this week. You know, the gun topic, there's more heat than light if you start turning on, you know, cable TV or listen to some of the commercial talk shows around the country. But you really have gone in-depth and in a number of angles with folks with a bunch of different perspectives. But to continue that kind of programming, we need your support. You can make a donation online at WXXI.org. Safe, secure way to do it online. Or you can call 454-6300. That's 454-6300. Again, a very important pledge drive. We've been expanding the scope of what we do with a talk show, with the news department. But to continue to do the kind of work that we're doing and the great work that Evan is doing, we need your support. So please show some of that today or at least during the next week or so.
Thank you, Randy. We continue our conversation with Michael Shermer now. And first up on the phones is in Farmington. This is Keith. Go ahead, Keith.
Kind of an interesting show. Got a couple comments. I try to consider myself, you know, not a conservative or a liberal, but just someone that would say, you know, show me, prove it to me.
Open to evidence. There you go. Sure.
Right, all right. But on data and information, you can take all the numbers on a specific thing, create some data, and come to a conclusion. But let me give you an example where it still could be wrong. I've had this ongoing discussion with a gentleman who's well-known in the Rochester area about a single-payer system. And the big concern, now this is maybe 10 years ago, a little bit longer, where if you have a single-payer system, everybody's going to go to the hospital with every ache and ailment, doctors, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to, the cost will be crushing too high. My comments were, you know, it's cheaper to keep people healthy than to cure them. Well, I got sent to me a chart stating, showing where in industrialized nations, as the population ages, it's a steady increase in cost, which you would think. But in America, it looks sort of like a hockey stick. It goes slightly up, you hit 65, and then it skyrockets. And the conclusion was, see, a single-payer system will increase the cost. That was the people who came up with this chart's interpretation. Now, I looked at it, and since I was close to the Medicare range, I looked at it. I go, no, it's not that they're spending it. It's that the ones in their 60s, early 60s, don't have health insurance, and they're just hanging on until they get to 65. That's why you have the spike at 65.
Is this a pitch for single payer? Where are you going with this, Keith?
Well, no, I'm just trying to say that the data, it could be, just because you get information that leads one way, it still could be wrong.
I appreciate that point. Michael Shermer, I think that applies to a lot of different conversations. So tell us how you sort through data, knowing that so many people try to use it in ways that benefit their own argument.
Yep, it can be a problem with complex issues like health care or even gun controls. I mean, you know, there's a lot of data sets. It's easy to cherry pick your data, go data snooping for the kinds of graphs and charts that seem to support your position. So one answer to that is to have counterpoint debates. And, you know, like in journals where you have open peer commentary, you have a target article, you know, like say John Lott's position, more guns equals less crime. Okay, and then there's, you know, like 10 articles that comment on that target article, and they present counter data, and you be the judge. So in a free society, you know, that's the whole point of having a free press, that is that one media source can say X and another media source can say Y, and then you, the consumer of information, can try to judge for yourself, and when you go to the voting box, make your rational decision that way. Admittedly, it's not easy to do because, you know, like your caller just launched into a whole thing that I don't know much about, because I can only follow so many different issues and healthcare and single payer versus whatever. You know, it's just not something I'm up on, but I can see how, of course, watching politics, it gets slanted in either way, in either direction, based on which data set you want to choose. This is why, like, we talk about the climate consensus. We talk about global warming. The consensus, what does that mean? Well, science is not like a democracy where we depend on, you know, the truth depends on how many people believe it. It's not like that. When we talk about consensus, we mean 97% of all climate papers published in peer-reviewed journals support the, you know, anthropomorphic global warming, the anthropogenic global warming, that is human-caused global warming. And, well, what about the other 3%? Maybe they're right and the 97% are wrong. You know, they laughed at the Wright brothers. You know, they laughed at Galileo, whatever. But the problem is that the 97% of climate consensus papers all converge to a single set of conclusions and points consistently over and over and over, whereas the 3% are all over the place. You know, oh, no, the warming's due to sunspot activity. No, actually, sunspot activity is at an all-time low. Oh, okay, well, it's due to, radiation from the stars, and that changes the sun, the cloud activity. No, it's not due to that because of so on. So there's no consistency there. So people mistake this idea that a consensus is somehow science based on authority and democracy vote. No. It's just, yeah, at some point in a particular field, there's a convergence of evidence, and almost everybody can see what the answer is to the question. And there's always going to be a few holdouts that don't believe it, and that's okay. You know, call them skeptics or heretics or whatever. It's okay to have them, but and give them a voice. They're free to write their own papers and books and so on. But the consensus is an important idea in science.
Well, Dave online is listening to this, because if you're just joining us, Michael Shermer, my guest, is somebody who used to not believe the current consensus on global warming. He was skeptical of using this kind of data for kind of a government overreach or policy prescriptions. And Dave said, well, the data has been clear for a long time. Why did it take Shermer as long as it did to reach his conclusion?
Well, in part, it wasn't a subject I was following closely every year. I remember being in college in the 70s when the whole ecological movement first began, and that's when the doomsayers were really quite dominant, you know, like Paul Ehrlich and wrote that book, The Population Bomb, and there were others saying, you know, that by the 1980s there'll be no more rainforest and we'll be out of coal and gas, you know, peak oil, and, you know, there'll be billions of people starving, you know, most of the half the world population will be starving to death and living in abject poverty. It's going to be worse than it's ever been by the 90s, and none of that happened. In fact, just the opposite happened. You know, we have more forests than we've had in the last century, and there's fewer, smaller percentage of the population is starving and living in poverty than ever before. And, you know, the trends have gone the opposite way. So in the 90s, when I saw that, I kind of came back to the subject, I thought, you know, the doomsayers are wrong. They're just wrong. And I still think the doomsayers are wrong. That is, even though anthropomorphic global warming, I think, is the consensus and right, I don't think we're doomed. I think we can do something about it. I think we are doing something about it. We need to do more. But that essentially, I changed my mind about the scientific question. The question of what we should do about it is more of a political question. I think we should do something about it. I'm slightly more in favor of technological scientific solutions like electric cars. Great idea. You know, let's get off oil. You know, this isn't going to happen in 5 years, but it could happen in half a century. You know, all cars in America could be electric. We're getting there. We already have, you know, Tesla has a 260-mile driving range. I live in L.A. You know, you can get anywhere. No problem. Once the infrastructure is set up with electric charging stations all over the country and everybody else is coming out with electric cars and hybrids now, and we're going to get off that Saudi oil, which is also a good thing politically, terms of our foreign policy, not being dependent on Middle Eastern oil. There's a lot of good reasons for that. But in a century or two, we really have to get off fossil fuels. They're a dirty, you know, a dirty kind of fuel. Better than what we had before, which is, you know, horses and water. But, you know, water wheels or whatever. But you know, the you know, renewables and all that is the way to go. So I think we're getting there.
Okay. And do you think we need to start teaching things like confirmation bias? I think it should be taught starting in middle school. I mean, I think people need to be growing up on the idea that you should always be on guard against trying to only confirm your own beliefs. Do you agree?
Absolutely. That should be part of every curriculum every year.
But it's not.
I know it's not. I teach it myself. I teach at Chapman University one night a week, Thursday night, for 3 hours. I teach critical thinking. And this is what we teach. You know, it's called critical thinking, but I really teach all, like, cognitive biases and how thinking goes wrong and all the errors and mistakes we make in our thinking. It's critical. We got to do it. I mean, even like in courtrooms, I think every juror should be taught, should be given like a 1 hour, you know, course on the confirmation bias alone. That this is what these lawyers are going to do when you're sitting there. They're going to give you only slanted data. That's their job. You know, the job of the lawyer is to win his case, not to figure out what happened. And, you know, they got to know that. They got to know this is how lawyers are going to try to manipulate you. They're going to use these kinds of words because they know those words are more emotionally evocative for their client. And so you just something like that. You know, a jury of your peers, yikes, that's kind of scary. How about, you know, some peer, you know, probably never going to get to professional jurors, although I wouldn't mind that idea. But at least some training. Like, before you become a juror, you have to sit and watch this one-hour film or get a one-hour course on you know, how to think critically about evidence, because you're going to be presented with evidence and it's going to be slanted on purpose by the other by the lawyers. So here's how to evaluate it.
Mm-hmm. Like, well, before I get back to the phones, and we'll finish the hour because all the phone lines are lit up now, Michael Shermer, the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, is my guest. And Michael, on this program recently, I've quoted your work on the question of mental health. It seems like in response to the gun control argument, some people say, no. See, what we really need is better mental health, and that will help solve it. Gun control is not going to solve it. Mental health will. You wrote for Skeptic one of the most persuasive pieces I've ever read about the challenge of predictive mental health work regarding violence, in that you laid out so well why it is essentially a fantasy to think that we're going to be able to kind of interrupt that. Now, on my Twitter feed, I've posted the article that I'm talking about. You can check it out right now at Evan Dawson. Michael, what's your short summation? And, you know, give us a couple quick data points on the idea of, well, if they've got psychopathy, well, hey, round them up. You know, let's figure out who's got it and deal with it that way.
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't want to live in a society where you can do that. And in fact, one of the reasons that the mental health laws changed in the 80s under Reagan was it was too easy to lock people up for mental health problems who you simply didn't like. You know, just a member of your family that you were angry at, you could just call up and report them for, you know, mental health issues, and they could be locked up, you know. So there were some freedom issues there that I think got resolved. But one of the side effects of that is that a lot of it became harder to get people help that really needed it. Now, the prediction problem is substantial. That is, the population of over 300 million people, and by the way, over 300 million guns, you know, it's virtually impossible to predict who's going to get the gun and who's going to snap it at any particular point. All we can hope to do is get people that need mental health treatment, get them the treatment they need, but we should be doing that anyway for other reasons. And if in our net we get a few that might have snapped and gone on a mass public shooting, well, all the better. But the idea that we can predict which school or theater is going to be subject to a mass public shooting, impossible. I mean, you'd have to arm every theater. You know, there's what, like 8,000 theaters in America. You know, and how many schools are there? You know, tens of thousands of schools. You know, this would be hugely expensive. And the assumption is that, you know, a single armed guard, you know, he'd have to be sitting there really, as I said, with his hand on the gun ready to go, because anybody could just walk up and shoot him, and then you're clear. There's no more armed guards there.
Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, let me debunk this other myth of the, you know, that the shooters go after gun-free zones. They don't. There's no evidence that any of these mass public shooters systematically search out and find which are the safe places to go on a mass public spree. They usually go to, like the guy in Oregon. He was a student there. He went to that school because that's where he was a student. It wasn't because he scouted out and went on the NRA webpage or wherever to see where the gun-free zones were so he could then case those places. No, that isn't what happened.
Read his work. Read Michael Shermer's work that I've posted, listeners, because he gets into more of the details on psychopathy, the numbers, how many people have it, males more than females, what degree, and how many people with psychopathy are even violent. In the coming weeks on this program, we're going to have James Fallon on the show. James wrote a book about figuring, he's a neuroscientist who realized in analyzing his own brain scan that he's a psychopath. He's a nonviolent one. And we're going to talk to him about that. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions, and Michael really works very, very well with them in helping us understand that when you hear people say, well, it's a mental health issue, that will stop it. It will not stop it. And we can't round people up and put them in jail, even if they do have psychopathy. Back to the phones we go, and we have Helm in Rochester. Go ahead, Helm.
I'd like to talk to the issue of confirmation bias. And I believe that theory is a confirmation bias in itself, in that having a strong belief is not healthy. So I can say this, that it's good to have people have strong beliefs, and it's not so good that we always attack these beliefs. And I'm saying that as a liberal, that conservatives with strong beliefs are good for society, and liberals with strong beliefs are good for society. So the beginning of attacking these strong beliefs are not really necessarily good for overall mental health or societal health.
Helm, only because the connection isn't great, I couldn't fully make out all of it. Michael, you want to respond to what you heard?
I didn't get that. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear it.
Yeah,
something about the confirmation bias. Yeah, the confirmation bias is the mother of all cognitive biases. I mean, it is really potent. There is now 25 years of studies on it showing how biased we all are. You know, for example, if you give a group of self-reported Republicans a healthcare policy paper, and you tell them it was written by Democrats, they'll rip it to shreds, rank it a 2 out of 10. But if you tell them it was written by Republicans, they'll give it an 8 out of 10, they'll say it's great. You know, just who you think wrote something automatically biases you against it or for it, depending on which side they're on. And, you know, there's lots of examples of that. If you tell somebody that the person they're about to meet is extroverted and friendly and gregarious, that's exactly how they'll perceive them, regardless of how they really are. And it's kind of disturbing. And, you know, if I knew what mine were, I wouldn't do them. You know, that's the problem. The fish in the water, you just don't know. So you have to really look out for it. You have to ask friends and family members, hey, am I screwing up here? Am I really off base? This is what I think is right, but, you know, maybe I'm wrong. This is why scientists have colleagues that they go to and go, hey, I'm thinking about writing this paper about X, but, you know, I know it's controversial, but, you know, what am I missing? Am I really just blowing it here? And then, you know, hopefully they'll tell you if you are. And because without the checks and balances, that's why scientists shouldn't work alone. That's why most of, like, the pseudoscientists that I deal with in my Scientific American column and Skeptic, you know, they don't understand. They think, well, here I am working in isolation. I'm in my garage. I figured out why Einstein's wrong and it was wrong. My theory about the universe is right. Have you checked with anybody? Have you called, like, a local physics teacher and said, you know, hey, I'm not quite sure about this. I think Einstein was wrong. But, you know, he's a pretty big name. Maybe I better check on this first before I publish it. No, they don't. They just publish it. And then when no one reads it, they go, oh, you know, the people, they're just closed-minded. You know, they're dogmatic, and scientists are, you know, they're not open-minded. They don't want change. It's a dogma, and so they just don't understand the social nature of science.
Back to the phones, Paul and around the Quake. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I kind of got two comments. During the 50s, when I grew up, when you went to the bank on Main Street in downtown Rochester, there was armed guards and there wasn't any robberies. Over the years, we've seen more gun control, and now we've got mass shootings in our city. The other thing is, I don't know if you've ever had to defend yourself with a gun, but I'll tell you what, it's quite an experience, and it's not pleasant, but it gets the job done. And the other thing is, we got a lot of people that seem to be associated with government agencies, politicians that are running for office. They're all protected by guns. So, if they're going to have protection, you can't pick and choose your protection. When you need it, you need it.
But, Paul, let me try this before I kick it over to Michael. You say that, you know, in the 1950s, 1960s, armed guards had guns here, and now we see more shootings, more mass shootings, even in Rochester. Well, there are way more guns today than there were then. A lot more guns today than there were then. And by the way, in this country, there have been mass shootings going back to the 1800s. So this is not a case where there weren't any mass shootings at all. So I would just say, just looking at the evidence you're presenting, it is not a very persuasive case one way or another.
I'm not trying to make a case, though. I'm just telling you the way that I see it. When I used to go down on the bus with my mother to the bank, there was armed guards there, and you felt safe in the bank.
Okay, Michael Shermer.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah,
I don't,
sure.
You know, we got a lot more people in the country. You got a lot more guns. You got a lot more everything. You got more highways. You got a lot more cows.
Yep.
You got a lot more everything.
Okay, Michael Shermer, go ahead.
Yeah, well, he's absolutely right. A gun can stop a bad person, no question about it. You know, men are bigger, stronger than women, and gun is a great equalizer for women. All that's true, you know, when we only talk about the stories, the examples, the anecdotes of, you know, good people that shot bad people, and there's plenty of them. I get letters all the time, but there are plenty of stories of, you know, when the right thing happened, the good person shot the bad person, end of story. And, of course, that is why banks, you know, have armed guards, and this is why the police carry guns, and they should. But imagine we had a technology that was better than a gun, just as good as a gun at stopping a bad person. Something like a taser that consistently worked, that didn't lead to people committing suicide and accidentally shooting their head off and having spousal fights and killing each other. You know, something like that, wouldn't we be in favor of that instead of a gun, in terms of just getting the job done of self-defense and stopping bad people? That would be the point. Of course, the police do have tasers, and they do try to use them, and they use the rubber bullets and so on. They're not quite as effective as guns, which is why police still use guns. And, in that sense, your caller's right. But, of course, it's what about all the other examples where, you know, the guy pulled a gun and he shot himself or he shot the wrong person? I mean, the moment you pull out a gun and start shooting, you know, it's just chaos. And who knows who's going to get hit? Maybe the bad guy gets hit, but maybe the bad guy gets hit and three other good people also get hit as the bullets are flying. And, you know, when you read these stories or you see these, you know, movies or accounts of these incidents that happen, you know, it takes like half an hour on the screen for the event to unfold. In reality, it was like 8 seconds. You know, the whole thing we're talking about happened in 8 seconds.
Yep.
Inside the bank or the school or whatever. And you know, we all read this and go, oh, well, this is what I would have done. You have no idea what you would have done. You know, you're thinking rationally, sitting here, in your chair, reading your morning coffee, reading the story in the paper. Well, I would have done this. You don't know that that's what you would have done. I would have pulled my gun. I would have shot the bad guy. End of story. Yeah, well, you know, again, go down to a shooting range and try shooting a revolver. I mean, it has a huge kick. It's really loud. It's scary. I mean, these things are really powerful These are not toys.
Well,
again, just think of it more like a pilot's license. You know, well, you're not going to just go down to the local airport and jump in a plane and see what it's like. You got to practice.
Michael, I wish we did have another hour with you, but I've got to leave it there. I will tell our audience again, it's skeptic.com, Skeptic Magazine. His new book is The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. Check out his TED Talk online where he talks about whether it's the wind or a predator for a sense on how we form beliefs. I love that analogy that Michael gives us there. So much to think about and the way we form beliefs. Michael Shermer, thank you for spending the hour with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And you can find more of his work. I've linked to it on Twitter as he writes about the questions we have about the evidence about guns in this country. And he's a man who's changed his mind on a lot of issues. Let's take a short break, come back, and Education Friday next on Connections.